This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, and welcome to this week's Science Extra bonus episode. My name's Jonathan Webb, and this week I have Olivia Willis in the studio to review the year that was in health news. Olivia is the online health reporter on my team. G'day, Liv.
Hi there.
First of all, a very big story about the way that mental health is handled in our emergency departments. This is how part of the story broke on AM way back in February.
A snapshot of waiting times for mental health patients presenting to hospital emergency departments paints a disturbing picture. Nearly one-third of patients presenting with acute mental health issues had to wait at least 8 hours for a bed, with some waiting several days. The Australasian College for Emergency Medicine, which compiled the data, says the practice is discriminatory and dangerous.
So that was back in February. What did we learn and how's the story unfolded since then?
So that was kind of the first report, I guess, last year, and obviously captured there. They found basically that mental health patients are waiting longer than people presenting with physical ailments at EDs around the country. And I think anecdotally that's been known for a long time, but it was kind of confirming that. And then there were a series of reports throughout last year that kind of built on that original report and gave us a clearer picture of what was going on. So there was one particular story in WA where there was a patient waiting for 6 days in an emergency department for an inpatient psychiatric bed, which is fairly extraordinary.
6 days is a long time in an ED.
Particularly, you know, for someone in mental distress, they're not a place that's particularly conducive to
recovery.
To recovery or the environment that you need. So it's obviously problematic for lots of different reasons. In September, the ABC revealed there were psychiatric patients that had basically been using towels and blankets to make makeshift beds essentially on the floor of EDs because, again, there's not enough inpatient beds. And we know that there's been also an increase in the number of people presenting to EDs with mental health problems. So particularly young people, there was, I think, a report maybe in June or July, which found the number of children, particularly in New South Wales and Victoria, had gone up.
So we've had a report and we've had some of these individual horror stories and certain places, maybe individual hospitals around the country where the situation's particularly bad. Is this reflective of a system that's in trouble?
I think so. That seems to be the thing that is coming out of these vignettes of what's happening around Australia. And certainly that's what emergency department physicians are saying, and I guess mental health experts too. You know, there is absolutely things that need to be done to better equip EDs to make them places that are more suitable when people arrive in psychiatric distress. The step before that is community mental health services, which are clearly failing in some instances. And that's why it seems that EDs are kind of a final resort, or where people go when they have nowhere else to go.
What's been done about it after all of these revelations?
There was a productivity commission announced by the federal government late last year. I guess that's kind of looking at it from an economic angle, which might in some way surprise people because you think, well, these are people's lives at stake. That should be enough rather than needing an economic reason for it. But I suppose the good thing about this commission is that it puts it on the economic agenda of the government and gets them to look at, the idea is, how are they currently spending mental health budget? So it's about $9 billion that goes into mental health services each year at a federal and state level. And so it's looking at, how do we use that money? How do we use resources? And are we using them in the most effective way? I think it'll be unlikely that there's cost cutting to be done. I imagine there might be the same funding, if not more, probably more into community-based stuff and preventative services. So obviously crisis care is key, but how can we get in earlier so we don't have the situation in EDs that is currently happening?
So that people don't end up in the emergency department needing mental health treatment.
That's exactly right.
Try and arrest it before that. Another area where we saw a bit of a tide potentially showing signs of changing was the uptake of health insurance, which seems to be not quite as popular as it once was, or at least the uptake is not growing at the rate you might expect. And Norman Swan, our colleague in the ABC Science Unit, did a Four Corners investigation on this early in 2018, and here's a little piece from that.
Well, it shocks you. I mean, you live in this world, I suppose, where you have Medicare, a universal health fund, you've got a private health fund, and lo and behold, you're 18 grand out of pocket when you have one operation.
I recall the receptionist saying to me, oh, look, I think you'd be pleasantly surprised by it. It's not going to be as much as you think. But then when it came out, I was like, oh my gosh.
So a few people there facing bigger bills than they expected, given they had insurance. And that seems to be one of the big problems here is you can still get a big bill even if you might think you're covered. What did this investigation reveal, Liv?
You know, a lot of people have that experience where they have health insurance, they, for whatever reason, need to go to the hospital or have some kind of treatment done, and they find at the end of it, they're hit with it, you know, can be a really significant out-of-pocket costs. And it kind of makes you think, well, why did I have health insurance in the first place? And generally, the common reaction is to kind of blame the insurer or Medicare for the rebates that it provides. But what Dr. Swan's investigation through Four Corners was looking at was actually finding that in a lot of cases, the fault lies with rogue medical specialists who are charging extortionist fees for specialist services.
And is it fair to call them, you know, rogue doctors, rogue practitioners, or is this the system that we've got and they're operating within the law? Is that no laws have been broken?
That's the thing. They're operating in the laws as far as I know. And Australia is quite unique in this situation that doctors can essentially charge what they like. But certainly doctors and medical bodies were, I think, keen to point out that these are rogue specialists and this is malpractice from a few bad apples and is not a really widespread practice. But in saying that, it's not good for the patients that end up with these exorbitant costs.
And what can be done about it if it's not necessarily the insurance companies that are in control in some ways? The coverage is doing what it was set out to do, but the fees are so high that they're not covered. Mm. What's the solution, if there is one?
Well, at the moment, there's an advisory committee looking at out-of-pocket costs, which has been chaired by the Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy, and that's looking at ways to ensure that people are better informed of fees before agreeing to treatment. But I think the key thing here is it's quite a complicated system, private health insurance and specialist costs. And when I was looking at this story, I could not believe how complex it was, even just for me to get my head around gap costs, schedule fees, booking fee, all this kind of stuff. It's really difficult.
Anyone who's sat down with their own budget and tried to work out whether it's worth it to take out private health insurance has the same impression, I think. It is a complicated system with lots
right.
of ins and outs.
Right, exactly. So I think in this case, the key thing is to try and get a better understanding of how it works. So normally with health insurance, if you have hospital cover, for example, the gap cost is covered with your insurer. But insurers don't cover medical services outside of hospitals that are covered by Medicare. So that's specialist visits, that's diagnostic imaging, you know, quite a few medical services. And that means that people are left to pay this gap fee. So the gap fee is normally kind of what the rebate is versus the schedule fee. The schedule fees are what the government says people should be paying for a service.
Right. So the government sets a rate that they think should be charged for things.
And then for this kind of stuff, you get an 85% rebate. So you think, okay, 15%, that's not that significant. But the issue here is then doctors charge their own fees and they're often well above what the schedule fee is. That's where right. that gap starts to emerge. And then there's kinds of things that, as the Four Corners show, in addition to doctors' fees, some specialists are charging what's variously known as a booking fee or an administration fee, which is essentially a non-refundable out-of-pocket flat fee that you basically have for the privilege of seeing whatever specialist. Medical bodies say it's unethical, doctors shouldn't do it, but it happens. And so for many people, when you're kind of putting that together, you're putting these gap fees from all these different services that they're getting that aren't covered, it adds up. And so out of the program, that was one of the follow-ups, was calls to say we need a more transparent system. Perhaps it is some kind of publicly listed thing where doctors can actually list their fees and people know what they are up front.
Interesting. Health insurance is another shifting landscape. And another legal framework that's seen some change this year is the status of abortion. Talk us through how things have changed in that landscape.
So there was significant news last year in Ireland, which was that they voted to repeal their ban on abortion and effectively liberalising what were probably some of the most restrictive laws on abortion in the world. And that was fairly significant for a once very deeply Catholic nation. I think that was quite a significant milestone for social change there. Previously, they had something in their constitution, the Eighth Amendment, which basically protected the right to life of the unborn, meaning that an abortion could only be carried out if the mother's life was at risk. The change in legislation means that the government will essentially allow abortions within the first 12 weeks of pregnancy and after 12 weeks in some circumstances.
How does that differ to the situation in Australia? We've also had some change.
We have, yeah. So last year, the big story was in Queensland, where abortion was decriminalised in one of the states, really the biggest kind of legislative reform there. And it was significant because Queensland previously, of all states or territories, probably had the most restrictive abortion laws in Australia. So along with New South Wales, laws that had been in place since 1899 and had not changed since then. So up until last year, abortion remained in the criminal code. The new laws, which were passed in Parliament in September, mean that women will be able to access abortion up to 22 weeks gestation. And so it's kind of turned the spotlight to New South Wales, because New South Wales, abortion still remains a criminal offence and has since 1900. But of course, pregnancy terminations are carried out widely around New South Wales. And pregnancies can be terminated legally if a woman's mental or physical health is in danger. But in saying that, women or doctors who break the law still face 10 years jail in New South Wales. To my knowledge, no one has been convicted on an abortion-related crime in kind of recent memory. What was interesting, after it was legalised in Queensland, it was kind of like, oh, well, now it's just New South Wales that's left. But actually, it also, most people don't know, it remains in the criminal code in South Australia as well.
Is there any movement there to make a change?
There was a little bit of talk around that after the Queensland decriminalisation. What's different, however, in South Australia is that access is actually easier in South Australia than in many other parts of Australia. And most abortions in South Australia are carried out in public hospitals, which is not the case in other states. But again, in New South Wales, it's legal to get an abortion if two doctors agree that a pregnancy would be harmful to the woman's health.
Thanks very much for coming in to talk about last year's health news, Olivia Willis.
Thanks for having me.
Next week's Science Extra Bonus is all about technology and some of the big issues that faced the world of tech in the last year. Thanks to Liv for joining us this week and to producer Joe Kahn. I'm Jonathan Webb. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.